Thanks for asking me, Larry. I'm Peggy Rose Levin. I'm an alcoholic. I'm super really nervous tonight, and I told everybody I wasn't. Super nervous. When I'm nervous, what happens is people are walking around, talking, doing things, and I think they're all ignoring me. And I think I'm a terrible speaker and that I'm ineffective. I think that I've just said something to embarrass myself. I think I'm a bad messenger of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I really have no business being up here, and you guys are all thinking that, and you're wondering what the hell I'm doing up here. And I might as well just sit down right now because you guys have all kind of made up your mind that this is going to be a really boring talk and she's not going to be funny at all. We really wanted the entertainer back from last week, that guy. He was funny. And we want that guy back, and we want probably somebody who's really, you know, established in Alcoholics Anonymous, who was very famous, maybe one of the circuit speakers. We'd rather them be speaking, not little old Peggy Rose. But, you know, I am an alcoholic, and I do have a story. And I guess the purpose of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is where we share our experience, strength, and hope, where I share at the podium like this. And I've shared in podiums like this since I was brand new. And what happened when I was brand new and I spoke at a podium is the opposite of what I thought was going to happen. I thought it was going to be an ego-inflating experience. And what happened was it was an ego-deflating experience. So I know that coming to the podium is something that always brings some kind of a humility into my life, and I really love that. I love that about speaking in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hate the thing about coming up and, you know, all the anxiety and, you know, all the things that I think I should be saying and think I have to look like and be and all this. But and as we know, none of that really ever is important. You know, when we take a cake at the end of the day, at the end of the year, nobody gives a crap what you did that year. Nobody cares what you said to your neighbor. Nobody cares how you screwed up and stole money from your job. Nobody cares how you lied and stole. Nobody cares. They just love you for you getting that cake, you know, and you got a year's sobriety. Thank God, you know, the program works. And, you know, bottom line, that's what it's all about. We don't really care. We don't care about what goes on out there. We care about the thing that happens in here, the spiritual thing that happens for us that we have no power over. And I want to welcome our newcomers here tonight. I wasn't in the room when everybody stood up to share that they were new. Larry had brought me a bottle of water that was, it was so warm. It was so hot. I said, I have to put that in the freezer because I'm just so hot. I can't drink hot water, you know. So I did. I stuck it in the freezer, and it's pretty cool now. It's good. I drove Yui Miata to the airport tonight. It was really a really difficult thing that I did tonight. Emotionally, she's been at my house for a month. I've been taking in people from other countries to learn English here into my home and being like a host. And I didn't realize that I could do that. I was really nervous about it. I didn't realize that I had any type of talent at all. You know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I pretty much thought I was nothing and nobody, even though, on the other hand, I thought I was the star of the show. And I should be the center of everyone's attention. So I had that going on when I was new, and I still do. So I don't know. My sobriety date is September 3rd, 1980. I don't know when that's going to change. Looking for fame and fortune, even in AA. Kind of looking for it. I've never had a drink of alcohol since I got to this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, or any mind or mood altering chemicals, except when I had surgery. Then I really needed it. I needed some narcotics. It was awesome though because I didn't get addicted, and I took narcotics the way they were prescribed. I called my sponsor on a regular basis. I wrote down every time I took a pill, and it worked out really good. So I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who has a story to share about taking drugs in sobriety, that they really, when you use them for what they're They're there for it. They really work. And they killed the pain, and they didn't spin me out into the fantasy world, and I didn't get that, you know, obsession back, and it was good. I took them for a couple of months, too, straight, narcotics, and, you know, you just, you don't want to be in that kind of pain, you know, so I wasn't, and thank God. I'm grateful for drugs, you know? Thank God they're there. They really work. I took Yui to the airport tonight. She was with me for a month. And, I mean, I had done this a month ago also with my first two students. And, you know, the connection, it's like, God, these are my long-lost sisters. It's like I never had a relationship with my sisters that was really good. I mean, they were horrible, my relationships. I have two sisters in real life that I grew up with. One's older, one's younger. And we just never really, you know, it's just has never been really good. And one sister in particular has been a horrible, I don't know how to describe it. Like, she's been here in the back of my life my whole life, and I didn't realize it. I mean, until, like, recently. I did not realize that that my whole life I'm operating under these resentments that I've had for this one sister. And I did not realize it. I did not realize how deeply ill I have been, you know. And it's just, it's been awesome. I've been taking the steps in a new way in the last year and a half. And I got to tell you, I'm really excited about what's going to happen. I'm moving from step 7 to step 8 right now. It's been about a year and a half. I started like last April, a year and a half ago. And I had gotten a new sponsor, and it was like, I had no idea we were going to start over on step 1. I was like, damn it. Every time you get a new sponsor, don't they do that? Don't they always say, you have to start on step 1? And I was like, I am not going to start on step 1 with this new sponsor. I just am not, you know, and I'm 30 years sober, and I'm not. And, you know, lo and behold, I got into this, like, realization, you know, that, and I, you know, I'm talking to her on a regular basis, and I'm telling her some things going on in my life, and it's like, I'm in fear, and I'm in anger, and it's every day, and it's all day, and I don't have any power over it, and I can't change it, and I don't know what to do. And she's like, I think we're going to go to step 1. And I'm like, yeah, okay. And so there I was at step 1, but it was like this, like, whoa. It was like, it was the deepest that I've ever, I mean, experienced in the steps. And I had no idea that I had missed it all these years, you know? I'm really, really grateful that I have been alive to find the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? To find the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not the steps that are on the wall, not the steps that are in this fantasy world, not the steps that I thought I was taking, not the steps that I wanted to take, that I thought maybe, you know, I really was as honest as I possibly could be, but I didn't realize that I was in this much denial. I did not realize I was in this much blindness, and I didn't realize I was this frozen. So I am really, really grateful that I have gotten to a place, you know, at least it was at 30 years sober, and I wasn't underground, and I never experienced it. That's how I look at it, you know. I got sober in Sonoma, California, in Santa Rosa, and I remember the first meeting I went to. I was told to go to that meeting because my friend was trying to kill herself with an abuse and Jack Daniels, and she was in the hospital and she was dying, and friend of ours said, you know, you better check out the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and really find out what alcoholism is. I had no idea. And, you know, what I was like growing up was I was really oversensitive and I was really grandiose. And I was really interpreting things that people were saying to me, like my family and friends and the way life, you know, happened for me. I really took things in a distorted way. Like, I thought they were talking about me behind my back, or I thought that when they were talking to me, that they were saying something bad to me when they were just saying something. I always seemed to misinterpret. You know, I was always kind of skewed, and I didn't know that, of course. And, you know, I can get that today by kind of looking back and seeing how I saw things the way they were when, you know, maybe they weren't that way at all, you know? Larry, thank you so much for letting me put that in the freezer. You know, he was really flexible about it, I gotta say that. You know, he wasn't really dug in to giving it to me hot. You know, he was open-minded, and that's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous right there. You know, that he could actually, you know, take a suggestion. You know, could I put it in the freezer? And, you know, I gotta say, you know, that's the program right there. So, but I've always had this, you know, kind of skewed way of looking at things and, you know, feeling insecure, and feeling less than, and this invisible thing. You know, I always had this invisible thing. You know, I remember, I clearly remember that when I went on a trip after high school, I went on a trip to Europe and I was in a train. And I clearly remember that I had this image of this little girl that was dancing on the hills as I was in the train, you know, going, you know, through Switzerland, through the different countries. And it was like, that was kind of like a mirror of how I felt about myself, that I'm really out there. Really, me here isn't here. You know, and the things that I have to say really aren't important. And I don't remember feeling like anything that I had to say was important or that I should speak. And I had a difficult time speaking. If you can believe that, I had a difficult time in my childhood and growing up to speak. In other words, I was an actress. I mean, I wanted to be on stage and I wanted to be, you know, the center of attention. But I also was frozen when I would get up on the stage. I would be frozen if somebody would ask me a question. I would go be paralyzed with fear. And I couldn't really speak my mind. I couldn't tell people the truth. I couldn't be honest with you about how I felt about something, what I thought about something. You know, if you said something to me, I couldn't really respond in an authentic way. So I had a very difficult time with that. You know, my whole upbringing, my whole life. And then, you know, in my drinking and my using and, you know, I started smoking pot when I was 19 and my boyfriend was, he was my dealer and he just had everything, hash and, you know, Thai stick and Colombian and Sinsemian. I mean, it was good stuff, let me tell you. And I smoked it all the time. And I had my own bong, and I had, it was called Rainbow Colors, and I smoked it every day. Anyways, I was really into it. And, you know, I had no power over that stuff. You know, and when it got to the point where I was, you know, running into a guy that I shouldn't have been with. It was my boyfriend's friend, and I shouldn't have been with him. And he and I went out to dinner, and we went to the surf and turf place. And I remember there was a jazz band, you know, playing over there on the side, and he ordered a gin and tonic. And, you know, up to that point, I had just been, you know, mostly smoking a lot of pot, you know, screwing up my life, you know, supposed to go to UC Santa Barbara. My parents were going to pay for it, you know, and I screwed it up. The first semester I left, and I was going to be a nun. My boyfriend was going to be a priest, you know, and we were going to, you know, have this love affair through the bars of the nunnery and the monkhood, whatever that's called. And, you know, it was my fantasy to be, you know, spiritual gurus. You know, that was my, you know, when I started this pot smoking thing, it was like, oh, I found God up in Joshua Tree and, you know, I'm having a spiritual experience and life is good. And I'd go home and I would be like this to my family, completely and totally withdrawn, until the point where I went home and I started yelling at my mother and I said, I'm not playing that piano. I'm not having my piano lesson today, and you can cancel it from now on. And I knew that she was my problem. you know, and I knew my dad was my problem. I knew everybody was my problem. And it's like it just accentuated it. So when I was out on this date with this guy in this jazz, you know, this jazz club, and he ordered this Tanqueray and tonic, and I had never had it before, and I thought, oh, wow, this is good. And a little lime, and I love little things. I already always had little petite things, little, you know, glass figurines, and I had a little dollhouse with little clothes of my doll. I loved little tiny things, and it was this little lime. It was on the little glass with the little ice cubes, and it was just me, you know, and it just was right. It was the right fit. It tasted right, you know, and it felt right. That was the main thing. It felt right. And I started to feel right, okay? I don't remember feeling right like this. And he ordered another one, and that jazz band was pretty crappy. And, you know, after a couple of drinks, they started to improve. And I really don't know if they did improve or if it was the Tanqueray and tonic, but I got a hunch. And then we went into the dinner, and, you know, he ordered this, you know, one of these artichoke things, you know, and it's like the fancy restaurant, you know, where the girl gets taken out, and she's, like, sitting there. That's me, just sitting there, and, you know, and he's, you know, and he's, and I look over at him. I did not realize this before. He has these puka shells on, and he's all tan, and he's a surfer with blonde hair, and he's got blue eyes, and this is my knight in shining armor, and I didn't realize it before, and it was like four drinks later, and I was right, and everything was right, and I knew, everything was going to be okay, you know? And, you know, I can only thank Tanqueray and Tonic for that, you know, that awakening that I had. And, you know, we left the restaurant together. I have no idea what happened because I tend to black out when I drink. And by the way, if you do black out and you don't know if you're alcoholic, it's one of the signs. That's what they told me when it came to sobriety. He told me when I came to AA, blackouts are a symptom of the disease of alcoholism. And I said, well, I black out, but I don't know if I'm an alcoholic. I don't know. Check it out. So, you know, something happened for me when I drank alcohol. Something happened for me that nothing else made happen for me. And I loved that. And I looked for that. And I have no power over alcohol. See, whenever I picked up a drink, and I went to places, you know, I ended up going to bars, you know, at the night, you know, like I'd smoke pot in the morning, and I'd get all, you know, insecure and removed from life. And then toward the evening, I'd need to bust out, so I'd go to the bar and get drunk. So that was pretty much my life. I had that dichotomy going. And I never knew who I was going to end up with. I never knew how much I was going to drink. I knew that I had to just go. I knew I had to go because I had to leave. I had to leave this. This was not okay with me. To be here with you or with anyone else, it was not okay. I could not be here with anyone, and I knew I had to go. So at the end of the day, I went, and I never knew how much I was going to drink. I never knew where I was going to end up or who I was going to end up with. And I got into some really disgusting situations. And I remember one morning I woke up, and I was at work that day. And I remember just feeling disgusted, just disgusted with myself. And I was lost. I had nowhere to go, nothing. And I looked out the window and I realized, oh, shit, I'm graduating today. Crap. There's my class. They're in their caps and gowns at the University of Long Beach, and they're all graduating. And I'm up there in the office, drunk, hungover. I didn't tell my parents I was graduating. I mean, they only lived like 10 minutes away. And I ran down there and I asked somebody, can I borrow that cap and gown? And I went up there just when they were calling my name, and I got my diploma. I was so hungover. I mean, it was like, it was pretty twilight. I mean, it was really, it was not good. And So that's what happens to me when I drink alcohol. And so what I was like was I would drink whatever was in front of me whenever. I would always, whether it was wine or beer or hard liquor, it didn't matter. No matter what drug it was, I took mushrooms, pot, cocaine, that didn't matter. I didn't care. If it was free, it was better, and I didn't care. So that was pretty much the way I was when I got drinking and in my active drinking years, and it was about 9 years of that. And, you know, I just went wherever the wind blew, and I always thought I was, always thought I had a better idea. And, you know, moving from Long Beach to Santa Rosa was a way better idea, you know, because that's where the Amazon women were. That's where they, you know, the real tough women were, the women who were really making a impact on life, you know. So I went up and I lived in this big house, and you know, there was all these people living in this big gigantic house in the country, and crazy things were going on. I was working in a gas station and pumping gas, and I was really proud of myself because I knew how to wash the windows really well, and it was Shell gas station. And I thought I was really hot stuff, and go to the bar every night, and, you know, working the day. And I remember one day I bent over to get the, you know how the safes, you know, in a gas station, you know, in a gas station how the safe is in the ground. You guys know about that, don't you? You know, you worked in a car wash before, right? Like, my dad owned a car wash. I used to work in it, and we had the safe in the floor there, too. So I was bending over to get into the safe, and my head felt like it was going to fall out and fall off. And somebody's, isn't it true that when you drink vodka, you don't have a hangover? I mean, you guys know, right? I mean, you don't get a hangover, right? Well, somebody lied to me because I had a freaking hangover that was unbelievable that morning. And, yeah, it was like that. So, so I was doing pretty good, you know. I got arrested, and just for walking down the street, you know, they arrested me, and I got thrown in jail. They said I had a speeding ticket. I had a warrant out. I didn't remember about that. So my girlfriend, she's a cocaine dealer, but that's okay because she bailed me out. It cost $90. When I got to sobriety, I paid her back $10 a week. I made my amends. Yeah, I made amends right away. I knew how to do this program. It was stupid. I was a college graduate. Come on. Make amends? Where is that? Make amends? Nine? $10 a week. I paid her a check. Anyway, so I thought my last drink was July 26th, 1980, but because I went to a concert and I, you know, we'd smoked some pot and somebody gave me a beer and I drank half the beer and that was it. And that's the last time I actually did drink alcohol, okay? It was July 26th, 1980. And then my girlfriend was doing her killer thing. You know, she's going to, I'm going to kill myself, you know, and abuse and Jack Daniels. So I'm like, I'm going to stop for you. And I'm going to stop. I'm not going to drink anything. I'm not going to take any. I'm going to be sober for you. And then I realized I needed to go to Al-Anon. So I started going to Al-Anon meetings, and I smoked pot again. But when I smoked pot this last time, it was in the middle of August, 1980, and I felt my feelings through it. I had never felt it like this before. And 2 weeks after that, I was in the women's restaurant where I worked, and this woman said, you know, I'm looking for some cocaine. Do you know where it is? Of course I do, because I'm famous, Peggy Rose. I know everything. I know where the cocaine is. My girlfriend, she lives right behind the police station. She sells cocaine. Just, you know, so we can go there right now. So we got in my little Volkswagen, and we drove over to her her house. The girl ran in, got the cocaine, came back. And I really wanted to say, just give me a couple bucks. I really wanted to say that. But I have no power. I have none over any mind-altering chemical. You know, and When she asked me if I would snort that cocaine with her, and I did. And I went to a co-alcoholic women's group after that, and I went to the group and I raised my hand, and I thought this was just what you do. I said, I snorted cocaine. And this was like, you know, it's Al-Anon women's group. Co-alcoholism, that's what we used to call Al-Anon. I snorted cocaine tonight, and I just wanted to be honest with you. And she said, the leader of it, Jan, she said, I just want you to know that if you take any mind or mood altering chemicals from the neck up, you can't change. And that went from here in here to here. Because wasn't that what I was trying to do my whole adult life? You know, since I was 19, I was trying to change. You know, with all that stuff I was smoking and all the stuff I was drinking and all that, you know, astronomy and astrology or whatever the hell I was doing. And the philosophy, I had a degree in philosophy now. And, I mean, all this stuff I was trying to change, I really was trying to change. I didn't want to be the way I was, and I was trying. And when she said that, I was like, oh, God, no. No. Really? No. Can't be. It can't be true. It can't be true. It can't be true. And it really hit me. And from that moment to this, it's been sobriety and it's been Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know I was an alcoholic at the time. It took a couple months for me to realize. It took about a month and a half from that point. Well, actually, it was 2 months. In the middle, about a month and a half later, I had a thought I might be alcoholic. Because I had started being an Al-Anon every day and going to AA meetings, and I thought I might be alcoholic, so. But I realized I'm an alcoholic. And there's a place for me. And I was really grateful. I was really grateful. You know, at the time, I didn't realize. At the time, I did not realize I didn't have any power. It's taken years in Alcoholics Anonymous, being of service in Alcoholics Anonymous, having so many jobs in this fellowship, and being a part of this program. It's taken so much to get to the simplest point that I have no power. You know, but I have to be honest with you. Most of my sobriety, I have thought I had power. And I have found that most of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous that I hear share have an illusion of control. We all have it. We have this thing. Unfortunately, we have this illusion of control, and until that's broken down, we still think we have some kind of power, and we cannot really access that power source. Now, I didn't know that. So about a year and a half ago, my new sponsor, you know, God bless her, she said to me, so Peggy Rose, how often during the day do you ask God for help? I'm 30 years sober. None? Oh, really? Well, maybe you could start asking. Because the things I was telling her going on in my life, you know, on page 52, the bedevilments, you know, they were all happening in my life. You know, they were, you know, these emotional turmoil I was having. I wasn't getting along with people. I was having crappy relationships with people. My work wasn't what I thought it should be. I wasn't making the money I thought it should have. You know, my home life wasn't what I thought it would be. You know, it's like every single area of my life was shit. Well, what are we going to do about this? And she's like, you might want to ask God for help. And I was like, no, it can't be. Can we try something else? Because I don't know what that means. And I didn't. And in this year and a half, I'll be honest with you. I'm 32 years sober right now. Thank you. I'm 32 years sober right now. And I barely, and this is honesty, I barely understand what a relationship with a higher power really means. Yeah, barely. Because I have stage 4 cancer. It started in 2006, and I had to have my female parts removed, and six months later, they found it all over my lungs, and I have stage 4 cancer, and so 5 years later, I don't have a problem with that anymore. It's been in remission, and, you know, I didn't really think about a relationship with God during that time, you know. I had a change happen for me. I've had quite a few awakenings happening. Awakenings and spiritual experiences, the way I look at it. And, you know, I forgot to tell you guys this when I started. I'm going to tell you now. I don't speak for Alcoholics Anonymous. Anything I share here is my experience. Personal. I am not the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, so I wanted to say that. So I've had a few spiritual awakenings. So the awakenings are the quick impact, you know, the quick change, the thing that happens like, whoa, wow, how'd that happen? I don't look at life the way I used to. What happened? That was fast. And then the spiritual experience is more like the educational, you know, the slow, you know, like, wow, I don't remember. I used to think that way, but I don't anymore. Wow, things are changing. Wow, that's great. So there's those two things that go on for us, and a lot of us, probably most of us, have had both and maybe not realized it. That's what's exciting to me. I love when I'm talking to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who really doesn't know that they had a spiritual awakening. I mean, really, the transformation that happens like that, you know, because it's really good news. I mean, most of us have had that in some form or another during our sobriety, you know. And that's happened to me a few times. It happened to me when I had 21 years of sobriety. I had an upheaval happen on the inside of me that I didn't do, that I didn't create and I didn't make happen. I have no idea where it came from. And I had a completely new outlook on life. And in one split minute, a second, like that. And I never looked. I was looking from over here, and then I started looking over here. I mean, 100%, it's true. I never looked at life the way I did again since then. That was 10 years ago. Now, there's another awakening happened for me, and that was another upheaval that happened for me, and that was a little bit more recent. I can't really describe much about it, but these are things that are so exciting, you know, and it makes me so grateful, you know, like I nearly died from alcoholism, I nearly died from cancer, and I'm alive, and I had no idea what my usefulness was in life. I never really felt like I had usefulness, and it's only in the last year and a half doing this process of the steps that I have an idea that there's a usefulness in my life. And I'm noticing it through my day. I'm talking to my sponsor and noticing it and reporting it and like, wow, it's so cool. You know, I also want to thank Brenda, Chris, and Kim for coming tonight. About an hour before the meeting, I knew I was going to be sitting there all alone. And it was going to be just me. And nobody cares. And then they showed up, and it was really awesome, you know, because there's some really amazing things happening in my life today with these women. And a couple of us just met about a week and a half ago, and it's been like daily, you know, intense working together, and it's been awesome. Thank you. So I started telling you that I dropped Yui off at the airport today. And that's something that's happened to me in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. This usefulness. This really knowing that the purpose in my life, you know, it's not like I know I have purpose and I'm going to do this, and it's not like that. It's like I feel like I'm starting to feel like, and this is what's so cool, I'm starting to feel like I have a purpose-driven life. It's like, this is good. Like, being here is good. It's not the terrorized life that I lived, you know, when I was married, and it was horrible. It was just horrible. The life that I was living, thinking I was in love. And now the life I've been living out here since my awakening 10 years ago in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I know the 12 steps work now. I know that they really work. I can't wait until I get past seven, step seven, and find out what the rest of the steps have for me. I get everybody, you know, just about everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous has had some experience in the steps, and I get excited when I hear your experience now. Before, it was just about, you know, screw you. Yeah, you had that, but I never got it. You know, that's how I really felt in meetings all the time. I was always envious, you know. It's like, but now it's like, yeah, okay, I get it. Yeah, okay, that happened for me too. Yeah, that's true. So it's kind of really cool. I feel like I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I feel love that I never felt before. And love is extremely wonderful. And I resented everybody for feeling it but me. And now I feel like I'm one of you. And it's good. And thanks, is it Rob? Rob, thanks so much for taping the meeting. He stood in to tape tonight real quick, and that was really awesome. Thank you. And I just want to say I'm very, very grateful to be able to come down tonight and share in my, like, home area. It's really cool because I really think that if you're new and you have an opportunity to share any part of your story, that's your responsibility, is to share it, because we can't stay sober if we don't share our story. And we all have our own story. You know, nobody has your story. So thank you.